This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 5th, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thousands of U.S. soldiers are steaming towards Uzbekistan, getting in place for a U.S. attack on Afghanistan. Might the U.S. dip into its stockpile of chemical weaponry in its attack against terrorism? We'll have a report. And we'll hear what Nobel Prize winner Oscar Arias, Costa Rica's former president, believes fosters U.S. hatred around the world.
I do complain and deplore that sometimes the U.S. doesn't exercise U.N. leadership. The world expects much more leadership from the U.S. on many of these issues, on debt forgiveness, on foreign aid.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The captain of a ship involved in recovering wreckage from the Russian airliner that crashed in the Red Sea has said that pieces of the pilot's cabin appear to have three bullet holes in them. Russian President Vladimir Putin said the crash seemed to be the work of terrorists. However, U.S. officials believe that the plane was downed accidentally by surface-to-air missiles fired during a large-scale Ukrainian military exercise. Ukraine officials have denied the allegations, saying that the missiles in question did not have adequate range to hit the plane. More than 70 people are presumed dead. U.S. intelligence officials have told members of Congress that there's a high probability that terrorists associated with Osama bin Laden will try to launch another major attack on American targets, either here or abroad, in the near future. Natalie Bell attended a hearing of the Government Affairs Committee in Washington today.
Dr. Amy Smithson, director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Project, disagrees and told House members today that terrorists will be unable to disperse any biological or chemical agents that would result in a catastrophic event like that in New York.
In our heightened state, I think there are a lot of Americans who are afraid that this is the sign of something worse to come. I simply do not believe that to be the case.
Local authorities, however, continue to stress the need to be ready and prepared in the event of an attack and emphasize that the focus should be placed on helping local governments. Mayor O'Malley of Baltimore, Maryland, voiced his concern.
When we watched it with horror, with all Americans, of what happened in New York and in Washington, we realized we needed to do more.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Natalie Bell.
The leader of California's largest right-wing Christian organization is calling for relief agencies to deny help to partners of gay and lesbian victims of the September 11 attacks. Lucia Appel is in Los Angeles.
Not all victims and survivors of the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, D.C. are equal, according to the Reverend Lou Sheldon of the Traditional Values Coalition. Sheldon called on public and private relief agencies to deny aid to surviving members of lesbian and gay relationships. Coalition spokesperson Steve Aiken told Free Speech Radio News,
"We do not believe that this is a proper time for homosexual activists to attempt to push their agenda to redefine what a traditional marriage is. Those that are trying to promote this are involved in a very cynical manipulation of a great tragedy."
But the Reverend Elder Troy Perry of the Universal Fellowship of Metropolitan Community Churches says the attacks have had an impact on gays and lesbians and their families as well.
As a church that deals in the gay and lesbian community, our denomination has raised almost $100,000 that we gave to the Red Cross. Absolutely. We have one member of our church in New York City who has burned over 40% of her body, is in a coma, is not expected to live, and certainly her spouse and her son certainly deserve to be helped during this crisis.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lucia Chappell.
An English journalist has been arrested by the Taliban for illegally entering the country. Miranda Kennedy reports from New York.
The Committee to Protect Journalists said it is greatly alarmed by the Taliban's announcement that Yvonne Ridley, a reporter for London's Sunday Express tabloid newspaper, will face trial. Taliban soldiers arrested Ridley and two male guides in a village near the eastern city of Jalalabad. She was reportedly wearing a burqa, an all-encompassing veil, and was not carrying a passport. Mullah Abdurrahman Zahid, the Taliban's deputy foreign minister, told the AIP that officials must determine if she is really a journalist or if she had some other intentions. British officials have also provided the Taliban with documents establishing Ridley's credentials as a journalist. The Committee to Protect Journalists says Ridley is effectively being held hostage as Afghanistan prepares for a possible attack, and points out that under the laws of the Taliban regime, espionage is punishable by death. In New York, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Free Speech Radio News.
The House of Representatives narrowly defeated a conservation-based amendment to the Farm Bill that would have redirected $19 billion to farms that reduce pollution. Gareth Schweitzer was on the Hill.
Members from big grain and cotton states voted against the measure, which would have diverted funds away from these traditional subsidy recipients and towards smaller farms. According to House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, the amendment's defeat represents a continuation of a decade of failed agricultural policy.
We wind up with what I think farmers least wanted, which is a huge subsidy and welfare program to farmers. Conservation should be an important integral part of our agriculture. So I felt that this amendment was at least the beginning of a movement to a more intelligent farm program in the country.
The conservation subsidies would have been available to small farms as well as produce farmers who are ineligible for subsidies under current federal farm policy. From Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
A 1,000 U.S. soldiers are on their way to Uzbekistan today, part of a massive buildup for what appears to be an imminent attack on Afghanistan. The troops from the 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, New York, are the first U.S. ground forces known to be deployed in the region. The disclosure came as the president of Uzbekistan emerged from a meeting with U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and announced he had granted permission for American forces to use an airbase in his country. Jeremy Scahill has more.
As Washington positions its forces for attacks against Afghanistan, British Prime Minister Tony Blair continues his stumping for the Bush administration. He was in Islamabad, Pakistan, closing the deal on that key country's cooperation with the coming U.S. attacks. At a press conference today with the country's military ruler, General Pervez Musharraf, Blair addressed what has become an unofficial aim of Bush's so-called war on terrorism, a change of government in Afghanistan.
We have agreed that if the current Taliban regime fails to yield up bin Laden, and it falls, then its successor must be broad-based, with every key ethnic grouping represented.
Meanwhile, Pentagon officials today confirming for the first time that U.S. Special Forces are heading to the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan. The 1,000 soldiers from the elite 10th Mountain Division specialize in winter weather combat. This comes as Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was in Uzbekistan today, working out the details of how Washington intends to use that country in its coming attacks. Uzbekistan is widely seen as a key entry route for U.S. military incursions into Afghanistan, though the country's president has publicly said he does not want his country used to launch attacks. Rumsfeld now heads back to Washington, raising the question of how soon the attacks will come. Before arriving in Uzbekistan, Rumsfeld said the Bush administration's war will closely resemble the Cold War. And Bill Hartung from the World Policy Institute thinks he's right.
I think the way they're setting it up, you know, demonizing the Taliban and bin Laden, willing to basically cut deals with almost anybody else for this immediate objective, is very similar to what they did in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan decided to send billions of dollars to the Afghan freedom fighters to fight the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And then years later, many of those same fighters ended up taking action against the United States, including many of the members of bin Laden's network. So I think it's the same short-sighted approach to coalition building, to sort of short-term thinking, as opposed to looking to more cooperative ways to work with a whole range of other countries to deal with the roots of the problem of terrorism.
NATO today gave Washington the go-ahead to use its airspace at will in its war. President George W. Bush now heads to Camp David, where he will spend the weekend meeting with his war cabinet. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
As Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld traveled to the Middle East this week to try to rally support for an international campaign against terrorism, the UN General Assembly held a debate on the topic. Over 160 countries took part. Without exception, they condemned the September 11th attacks in New York City and Washington, expressed sympathy for the victims, and pledged cooperation in the fight against terrorism. But as the debate showed, Arab and Muslim countries in particular differ sharply with the U.S. government's assessment of what fighting terrorism means. From the United Nations, Susan Wood reports.
On the opening day of the debate last Monday, John Negroponte, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., sought to reassure regional allies that the Bush administration's war on terrorism is not a war against Islam. But with 30,000 U.S. troops ringing Afghanistan and talk in administration circles of a wider war, Arab and Muslim countries fear they may be targeted. Many criticized racial and religious profiling. Saudi Arabia's permanent representative.
Some biased media repeat unjust hearsay about Islamic terrorism, Islamic threats, and Islamic bombs. Arabs and Muslims cannot be accused of terrorism because some among them committed terrorist acts.
While condemning slaughters of civilians as unjustifiable under any circumstances, many speakers pinpointed the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a source of rage giving rise to desperate acts. There were calls to end state terrorism, meaning, among other things, Israel's incursions into Palestinian territory. In the past week, renewed fighting in Gaza has resulted in the deaths of 25 Palestinians and 2 Israelis. Egypt's ambassador.
The thinking by some parties in Israel that there is now an opportunity to crush the Palestinian resistance to occupation by taking advantage of the current conditions gripping the whole world, that tendency will be a grave mistake of incalculable implications and their consequences.
Even Arab governments the U.S. regards as moderate and pro-Western said a successful response to terrorism must take into account the growing gap between the haves and have-nots. Many recalled the promises made at last year's Millennium Summit. Morocco's ambassador spoke through an interpreter.
Security will not be universal unless dire poverty, as suffered by increasing numbers of people, is overcome, as well as humiliation and injustice worldwide. Restoring hope to the oppressed must figure among the priorities of the international community.
As the U.S. seeks new alliances with countries it has long regarded as foes, Iran, which shares a 500-mile border with Afghanistan, rebuffed Washington's requests to use its airspace for possible military strikes. Speaking at the UN, Iran's Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs called instead for strengthening the rule of law.
As a tragedy caused by blunt hatred, the response cannot be indiscriminate retribution, putting many innocent lives at risk. It should focus on bringing the culprits to justice.
In the first 4 days of the debate, only one country, the Philippines, said it was prepared to make its airspace available and provide combat troops to the counterterrorism coalition. And only one country, Chile, said Resolution 1368, adopted by the Security Council on September 12th, gives the U.S. a green light for any retaliatory action it may wish to take. That resolution refers to the right of individual or collective self-defense provided for in the U.N. Charter. Cuba's ambassador, however, disputed this, saying any use of force against terrorism would require explicit authorization from the Security Council, which the U.S. has said it will not seek. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Strong words from Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Speaking hours after Israeli troops killed 6 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, Sharon said Israel would continue its military assaults in the occupied territories, even as the United States attempts to put together a military coalition to fight Afghanistan that includes Israel's Arab neighbors. Aaron Glantz reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon doesn't want the Bush administration to work with Arab governments as the United States builds an international coalition for war.
Do not try to appease the Arabs on our expense. This is unacceptable to us.
In recent weeks, Washington has applied pressure on Israel and the Palestinian Authority to end a year of violence to make it easier for President Bush to gain the support of Arab and Islamic states like Egypt, Syria, and Saudi Arabia. But at a press conference in Tel Aviv, Sharon said his government wouldn't play along.
We can rely on ourselves only.
Sharon compared President Bush's effort to work with Arab states to efforts to appease Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany before World War II. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington.
This is consistent with what the Sharon position has been, trying to assert that Israel will not play the same role that it did in 1991 when it agreed to stay on the sidelines of George Bush Sr.'s coalition in the interest of getting Arab governments on board.
Hours after Sharon made that statement, Israeli tanks thrust into the West Bank city of Hebron. Witnesses said about 50 tanks and armored personnel carriers accompanied by other military vehicles rolled into the city under cover of darkness. The army demolished, shelled, and rocketed homes. Troops ousted residents from 15 houses, positioning themselves on rooftops. 5 Palestinians were killed, and some 45 others were rushed to the hospital.
It reflects a view that he spoke of to his cabinet meeting when he told Shimon Peres yesterday that Peres should not worry about what the Americans think because Israel and American Jews control America.
In Washington, presidential spokesperson Ari Fleischer called Sharon's comments unacceptable, but refused to specifically condemn Israeli military actions in the West Bank.
Israel can have no better or stronger friend than the United States and better friend than President Bush. President Bush is an especially close ally of Israel.
There was no immediate response from the Arab governments that border Israel. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
The World Medical Association warned yesterday, nations are not adequately equipped to deal with terrorist attacks using biological or chemical weapons. The group, bringing together doctors' associations from 72 countries, said the threat posed by such weaponry demanded vigilance from all sectors of government down to individual physicians. Since the September 11th attacks, the threat of chemical weapons looms larger in many American minds. But as Monica Lopez reports, the United States may be just as likely to use biological weapons in its war against the Taliban.
The list of technologies reads like science fiction. Microwaves to heat human skin, genetically engineered microbes to destroy vehicles, and sound generators that vibrate internal organs. These are part of a list of non-lethal weapons that are already developed or are under construction for use through the United States Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program.
Typically, one medium for that is pain. So we look at developing capabilities like that.
Colonel George P. Fenton is the director of the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program in Quantico, Virginia. Fenton says that if the military is not going to use lethal force, they have to look at other ways to affect people's behavior in the field.
I'll look throughout the electromagnetic spectrum, and I'll see if there are things that we can, in fact, do. I'll look at mechanical and kinetic devices, acoustic devices. I'll look at malodorants, riot control agents. And again, when I look at these things, I have to look at them through legal ramifications. I have to make sure I'm working within the confines of the law and, of course, within the treaty obligations that our nation has subscribed to.
Although there are international treaties that ban the research and use of all biological and most chemical weapons, there are weapons in development that could potentially be used in the United States' impending war on terrorism. Some activists worry that those types of weapons will be used in this war. The Sunshine Project is an international non-governmental organization that documents a number of developing biological weapons technologies from the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program. Edward Hammond, director of the Sunshine Project, says the Non-Lethal Weapons Program has developed a range of technologies that include sedatives and hallucinogens to control crowds of civilian populations.
One of the types of technologies are called calmatives. And calmatives are not nice things that make you calm at all. In fact, what they usually are, or a number of them, are what are called dissociative hallucinogens, which basically separates your mind from your body. Ketamine, which is an illegal drug, is an example of this type of hallucinogen.
Hammond adds how the U.S. could potentially use these technologies.
They've been developing these weapons for use in two scenarios which are very likely to happen if the war on terrorism proceeds. That would be first, identification of terrorists and rescue of hostages, and second, controlling unruly crowds.
Colonel Fenton refused to rule out whether the U.S. will in fact use a possible war on terrorism to deploy some of these weapons.
With respect to the challenges that we are facing as a nation, as a result of these terrorist attacks, I believe that our nation will do whatever it takes to necessarily do what the president said, and that's to get on with and capture those responsible. But I don't necessarily believe some of the technologies that I'm discussing right now here have application in that kind of a scenario. I mean, that's like an apple and an orange.
Hammond notes that just a few months ago, the United States refused to sign the Biological Toxin and Weapons Convention at a summit of world leaders in Geneva.
Only a couple months ago, the entire world was on the verge of an agreement to provide a system which would send United Nations inspectors to suspect facilities around the world to investigate and to verify that they were not producing biological weapons. But we trashed that system. And not only did we walk away from that system, but we said that we would sit in the debate and prevent other countries from coming to an agreement. If we were, in fact, to use a non-lethal biological weapon, I think that other countries would be tempted to conclude that it's pointless to negotiate with the United States on chemical and biological weapons control because we're obviously not abiding by our treaty commitment.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Monica Lopez.
Oscar Arias, the former president of Costa Rica, says arrogance in the past has brought about hatred of the United States around the world. Arias, winner of the 1987 Nobel Peace Prize, believes a Marshall Plan emphasizing development through education may be what's needed to reverse the globe's growing inequality. Correspondent Lira Bartis caught up with Arias during a visit to Idaho.
When he was Costa Rica's president in the 1980s, Oscar Arias experienced the arrogance of the United States firsthand. It was then he brought the five Central American presidents to the table for peace talks that eventually ended the Contra War. Arias' efforts won him a Nobel Peace Prize, but also cost him.
I've been telling my friends in Washington that for the last 10 years, this has been a country in search of an enemy, because once communism disappeared, at least in my part of the world, in Central America, you cut the aid to the five Central American countries right away. So we were punished by making peace instead of being rewarded for having had the courage to silence the guns.
Costa Rica abolished its military in the 1940s, and Arias has stated that his country's best defense is to be defenseless. Although he doesn't think not having a military necessarily is a good idea for larger nations, Arias says he sees it as a positive for smaller countries like his own.
It's a pity that, for instance, Washington is not encouraging that. Just the opposite. Washington is selling arms indiscriminately. And now I just read that President Bush wants the U.S. Congress to get rid of all the restraints that the U.S. administration still has so that you could sell weapons to former dictatorships like, or current dictatorship like. A good example is Pakistan, for instance, and certainly many violators of human rights, but the U.S. is not very consistent on all these issues, as you are aware.
Arias says that sometimes he resents the fact that with a little bit of leadership from the U.S. administration in Washington, many countries could be spending much less on the military and be spending much more on education. That, he says, is why so many countries are still poor.
I do complain and deplore that sometimes the U.S. doesn't exercise your leadership. The world expects much more leadership from the U.S. on many of these issues. On debt forgiveness, on foreign aid.
Arias says lacking an economic Marshall Plan, the world's markets are now ruled exclusively by competition. But, as he told a group of business executives at a corporate ethics conference, there's a need for a safety net for those who are left behind in order to stem the tide of anger at the United States.
And let me tell you that arrogance is what is killing this country. Unilateralism. The American way, telling people what people need to do. It's either the American way or no way.
When he was the president of Costa Rica, the threat by the U.S. was to cut aid. Now Arias says the threat is, do as we say or we'll bomb you. Other examples of U.S. arrogance Arias spelled out were telling the Europeans we believe in the environment, but not as much as you do, so we won't sign the Kyoto Protocol on global warming. Telling Canadians we want to continue manufacturing landmines, telling the whole world we want to keep the death penalty for children so we don't agree with the International Agreement on the Rights of the Child, and telling the world we don't want the Test Ban Treaty or an international criminal court. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
British Home Secretary David Blunkett announced this week a Labour Party-backed plan tightening Britain's hate crime laws to cover religious as well as racial hatred. This may be too little too late to defuse the climate of intolerance in Britain. Since the September 11th attacks, there have been a rash of assaults against Muslims in the United Kingdom. James Smoot has more from London.
Before the World Trade Center attacks, racial relations in Britain were already very rocky. In the summer, race riots broke out in three cities in northern England, causing dozens of injuries and millions of pounds in property damage. Since the September 11th attacks, Muslims in Britain and those who just resemble Muslims have been the target of serious abuse. According to The Observer, there have been at least 30 reported serious assaults on Muslims in the past week in the United Kingdom. Hassan Muhammad Ali, a London social worker for the Council for Racial Equality, says 30 attacks are just the tip of the iceberg, as most people do not report racial attacks. He has been hearing about racially motivated attacks every day since September 11th.
An Afghan refugee, in other words, someone presumably who was fleeing the Taliban, who was working as a taxi driver in West London, was assaulted by a gang of racists outside a pub, beaten within an inch of his death, and is now lies paralysed from the neck down in hospital. I know of a young Somali refugee in southeast London who was hit on the back of the head with a brick on his way home from the mosque on after Friday afternoon prayers.
According to Muhammad Ali, the Muslim community in England is very frightened. Women who wear the hijab headscarf are afraid to go out of the house for fear of being verbally abused or worse. At every newsstand in the United Kingdom, Osama bin Laden's photo with the caption, "Terrorist," is being splashed across the front page of every newspaper. Bin Laden wears a turban and has a beard, so anyone who resembles bin Laden must be a terrorist. Muhammad Ali puts the blame for this situation squarely at the feet of Britain's political leaders and the media.
What's happening is, in the most of the media, our politicians are demonising the Taliban in preparation for war, and the message which they're putting out is being translated on the streets in a very violent fashion.
The media itself has acknowledged some of their responsibility for the general climate of racial intolerance. For months, the Daily Express has been waging a headline campaign against immigrants on the front page of the paper as a ploy to gain market share from their tabloid rival, the Daily Mail. Journalists at the Daily Express revolted in August against the anti-immigrant campaign. Their union passed a resolution condemning the headline campaign by a vote of 26-6, then went public. Mary Broadbent, a journalist for The Express, explains the reason for the resolution.
A lot of the journalists were complaining that they felt they were being used to sort of create stories which the headlines didn't actually mirror what the copy was, and they were objecting to their stories being sort of distorted but by these inflammatory headlines, headlines like "Refugees Run for Your Life" and "We Can't Take Any More Asylum Seekers," an asylum invasion, and one after the other, day after day. And so we just decided we wanted to sort of condemn the coverage because it was in a climate which was actually leading to a whole number of racist attacks in Britain.
While journalists may be revolting, publishers are sticking to their anti-immigrant stance. Recent tabloid headlines have accused Iraqi asylum seekers of smuggling bombs for Saddam Hussein and of setting up terror schools in the United Kingdom. Many fear that when the cruise missiles start flying, the attacks will get worse. For Free Speech Radio News, this is James Smoot in London.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and 4 continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 1-510-287-5551. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Padgett-Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown.